what's going on with Alaska's winter? Is it climate change, El Nino, the blob, all of the above joining forces, or just an anomaly? Will our winter be more normal next year, or are we seeing what is now the new normal for a part of the planet that is experiencing climate change at twice the rate of other places? There are a lot of questions, some confusion, and plenty of anxiety about how quickly our atmospheric systems seem to be changing. Alaska's warm, dry winter is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. I forgot to tell you that earlier. Remember the phrase, April showers bring May flowers? Normally, my tulips and daffodils don't start peeking out of the ground until late March or early April. But they've been above ground by a few inches for a couple of weeks now, and willow bushes are fluffed out in patches around Anchorage. Alaska is experiencing a strange mild winter. Last year was much the same. But although South Central broke a nearly 60-year record for no accumulation of snow this winter, mountains south of the city have above average snowpacks and high avalanche danger. So what's going on and what does it tell us about the future? We're undertaking a week-long look at our weird weather in the lead up to the Iditarod. And throughout today's program, we'll bring you some Alaskan voices describing what's happening in their areas. And of course, we welcome your calls. Also here to help us understand our changing climate are two guys who make their living that way. Rick Toman is the climate science and services manager for the National Weather Service based in Fairbanks and joins us from the studios of KUAC. Hello, Rick.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us. And also in the studio with me here in Anchorage is Brian Brett Schneider. Brian is a climatologist and he is with the International Arctic Research Center based at UAF, although you're based in Anchorage, correct?
That's correct, Lori.
Thanks for being here, Brian.
My pleasure.
So, Rick, I want to start with you. Clearly, this is a strange winter. Anchorage has to borrow a trainload of snow from Fairbanks for Fur Rondi and the lead-up to Iditarod. Looking at the state overall, where are the areas that experience the most dramatic winter weather? And I'm talking about both the lack of snow in places like Anchorage and Interior, but also the places that saw a lot of snow and precipitation. What's going on?
Well, what we've had, Lori, is a very persistent pattern since about Thanksgiving with a very persistent storminess in the Gulf of Alaska, southeasterly winds aloft, blowing those storms from the Gulf of Alaska back towards the Kodiak Island and the Alaska Peninsula. And as a result, places like Kodiak and on the windward side of the high terrain on the Kenai Peninsula and Prince William Sound have gotten a lot of precipitation. Kodiak has had one of their wettest winters of record. Alyeska up high has had a lot of snow. But you blow that moist air over the mountains and it comes down on the other side. And so leeward side areas like Anchorage, like most of mainland Alaska, have been very dry. And it's the persistence of that pattern that's led to Anchorage having one of its driest midwinters of record, while just an hour's drive away, there's a lot of snow up high.
There sure is. This is Talk of Alaska. If you're just joining us, we are talking about where's winter? Because in Anchorage, we have to borrow snow from Fairbanks. That's how poor we are in snow. You can join our conversation. We have climate experts on the program with us today. And throughout today's program, we're going to be talking about what is going on with Alaska's weather and what the future might look like. You can join the conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Brian, I want to get you in here on a little bit of follow-up discussion from Rick Toman talking about the records that we've seen. Brian, Brett Snyder is also a climatologist. First, tell us about your Anchorage business, Borealis Scientific. What is that?
Well, it's an LLC that I have climate consult. It's a consulting business, and I do environmental planning, I do mapping, and I do various climate and other kinds of consulting.
Mm-hmm. So, are you working with companies that are looking at maybe permafrost melt and things like that, where slumping is going to have to be factored into building?
In that context, not really. The business opportunities that I work with through my own company are primarily environmental planning, environmental permitting, and support activities for like NEPA documentation and even some like subsistence studies.
Mm-hmm. So for both of you, what are some of the big takeaways from fall and winter this year as they compare to last year, which was also mild, and what may be considered a more normal Alaska winter, if there is such a thing? Brian, let's start with you.
Well, I'd like to chime in on something Rick said, and that is that there's been a really dramatic gradient in precipitation. And, you know, if you go from Seward, Portage Glacier Visitor Center has had, which is 60 miles away from Anchorage, has had 66 inches of rain this year, whereas since January 1st. Whereas in Alyeska has had quite a bit, Girdwood. But then when you get mid-Turnagain Arm, it really turns off. And so like the snowtell at Indian Pass has had only, I believe, 6 inches. And then, of course, Anchorage and all the stations around town here, I believe, are all under 1 inch. So it's been in even just really short horizontal distances, quite dramatic change in the precipitation regime. But everyone has been warm, as Rick noted. Your precipitation can be spotty and can be, there's a lot of localized effects, but the air mass itself has been really anomalously warm no matter where you go from north to south.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about the Arctic and the high temperatures there, but there is a lot of ongoing discussion about our dismal winter in Anchorage. But give us some context historically beyond breaking a record held here in town since 1958. How dramatic is this year's weather and climate conditions compared to the past?
Well, I'll chime in first. It's not necessarily historic. There are individual records, like the snowless streak. We had our second warmest December, January, February on record in Anchorage, and our driest during the same period. So there are analog years in the past that are, you know, either slightly warmer, slightly wetter, slightly drier, slightly cooler. So this is in the ballpark of some other winters, but having two in a row is really uncommon.
Rick, you want to jump in here?
Sure. So just to amplify on what Brian said, really one of the outstanding features of this winter across Alaska is everywhere is substantially warmer than normal. That's different, for instance, than 2 years ago when we started the blob, when Southeast actually was pretty close to normal. This winter, everybody from Barrow to Ketchikan and Ketchikan out into the Aleutians, significantly warmer than normal. In the Arctic, it's been extreme. Barrow has had their warmest December, January, February of record, and we have unbroken climate observations of Barrow since 1920. That's quite substantial, and in fact, most of the warmest five winters in Barrow have been in the last few years. So it's not just that it's a warm winter in Alaska, but especially in the Arctic, this is part of course, the longer-term trend.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about the winter that wasn't in much of the state. If you'd like to join our conversation, what have you seen in your area this winter? More snow, no snow, plants sprouting in months that used to be considered the dead of winter, bad ice for traveling and winter hunting. How have you or your community had to adjust to changing winter conditions? Our numbers are statewide, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Rick, you were just talking about the warmth in the Arctic. January was more than 7 degrees hotter in the Arctic Ocean, 7.2 degrees than the average for that region. Absurdly warm, as one scientist put it. How do you explain what's happening there?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Some of it must be tied to significantly below normal sea ice coverage in the Arctic on the Atlantic side of the basin. And there's been several storms that have brought very warm air from the Atlantic into the Arctic basin. However, that only gets us so far. The overall pattern of circulation in the Arctic has had its periods when it's been anomalous. But overall, for the seasonal scale, it's not been terribly unusual, but nonetheless, we're seeing these very high temperatures, and so we can speculate on why that would be. But the bottom line would be that both the weather and the long-term trend have come together to push temperatures up this winter.
Brian, would you like to jump in there?
Well, as Rick noted, the local effects of sea ice, not just in the immediate vicinity of Barrow or the Bering Strait, but really basin-wide, and as Rick noted, like around the Svalbard Island, which is part of Norway, I don't think the sea ice ever even made it to the islands this season. So those, even on the other side of the Arctic Ocean basin, those kind of patterns really influence the entire region. And also, as Rick noted, storminess can advect warm temperatures, and it can provide a feedback mechanism that the area just never has a chance to recover.
The Arctic overall is warming at twice the rate as the rest of the planet, but the impacts are not isolated to the Arctic. Arctic warming impacts the jet stream. More and more, it seems, is being understood about that. And that's creating this interesting shift in where precipitation is drifting. Arctic moisture is making its way to the East Coast. Talk a little about what's going on there.
Well, there's been some research in the last decade and about the impacts of a warming world, particularly, as you noted, warming is amplified in the Arctic for several reasons. And that has this set of cascading influences on global weather patterns and weather features, one of which is the strength, the intensity, and the location of the jet stream. And so if you lower the temperature gradient between the tropics and the polar areas, it's pretty straightforward mathematically to determine that you're going to have slower jet stream. It's going to be a little bit farther north, and when you have a slower jet stream, it's more amenable, I guess, to having large deviations. You know, it's easier to displace it by large amounts. And so there's been talk that some of the big East Coast storms, for example, lower 48 East Coast snowstorms in the last few years, might be related to actually a warming Arctic basin, because the jet stream is being slower and more easily displaced. When it is displaced, it can drag cold air anomalously far south. So it's an emerging area of research, but it appears that the jet stream is responding to this global shift in temperature regimes.
And is it also sort of stalling out at times? It seems like some of these storms just go on, and it's merciless. And is that also what's happening, that the jet stream is drifting, but it's also kind of slowing down at times?
Well, I'll defer to Rick on this, but here in Alaska, particularly in northern latitudes, we tend to get stuck in patterns for a long time. You know, it might be warm and wet for a month, or you might not see a cloud for several weeks, and it might be, you know, just gripped in cold weather for long periods of time. And so depending on how wavy the jet stream is affects how stable it is, and those waves can be hard to displace. So Rick, how would you what would you like to add to that?
Yeah, Rick, is the jet stream stalling out?
So as Brian pointed out, at high latitude, so say, you know, particularly latitudes of mainland Alaska, this is not a new feature, this persistence of weather patterns. This is not new. This is part of weather and climate at high latitude. So the fact that, for instance, we've been stuck, if you will, in this particular pattern with storminess in the Gulf and southeasterly winds aloft over much of the state, that in and of itself is not new. The weather, and to the extent that the waviness in the jet stream is affecting the mid-latitudes, that's somewhat of a different question, is important to remember, especially in winter for Alaska, and again, mainland Alaska, southeast is, and the Aleutians are far enough south that they're a somewhat different story. That we are often far north of the jet stream, so it takes pretty big waves to really dramatically impact mainland Alaska in midwinter. But that being said, I think really the other point to make on that Brian was touching on is with these the waviness and in a warming world, a big feature of this is increased moisture available. If it's cold enough to snow, you can get a lot of snow, even if temperatures aren't terribly below normal. We saw that, for instance, in September here in the interior, where we had a lot of snow at the end of September. But temperatures at the end of September are not that much above freezing. It wasn't very far below normal. But what was really dramatic about that was we had extreme amount of moisture available. And we're seeing the same thing in some of these storms along the east coast of the United States. There's a lot of moisture available. And if it's just cold enough, lots of snow.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us or you'd like to call in, the numbers are 1-800-478-8255. We're talking about the winter that wasn't. 1-800-478-8255 or locally in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're going to go to the phones. James is in Valdez. Hi, James.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's going on there?
It's been a really, really non-winter here. And Valdez, you know, we take pride in our snow down here. We have a lot of extreme winter sports, heli skiing, snowboarding, snow machining clubs. We had a snowstorm a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago, where we were reaching close to 500 inches or something like that. It was to the point where, you know, they were going to call the Coast Guard in as a result because, you know, buildings were collapsing. But ever since, we've slowly watched our snow levels decline year after year. And, you know, usually at this point in the year, you know, there's a lot of ice on the roads. And, I mean, it has been nothing but pavement and clear roads this year. It's, and I was wondering if they kept a monitor of the patterns of the snow levels here and you know, what to expect here in the future. Because, you know, a lot of enterprises in here, they benefit and the town benefits from having people come in for, you know, these races and these extreme events. And I was just wondering, you know, what to look forward to. I think we've lost probably 1 to 5 feet of snow every year for the last 4 years. Mm. And, you know, it's been raining quite a bit. I was just wondering if anybody's keeping track of that and, you know, what to expect here in the future.
Well, James brings up a good point. He was talking about the Coast Guard, but I know that the National Guard got called into Cordova a few years ago to help shovel snow. So,
And there's Rick can really talk much better about this than I can, but there's an interesting history of observations in Valdez, and it's been somewhat in flux the last few years. So actually getting good observations these days out of Valdez is a little bit challenging. So I was actually curious myself what the conditions were like in Valdez. I don't know if James, if you're still on the line.
Yes.
How much snow is on the ground, and how much would you say has fallen this season, if you had to guess?
You know, on the season, I would guess maybe 6 foot. You know, and most of the buildings here, there's no snow on the buildings whatsoever. It's all been rained off, and you know, if it's not raining, the sun's shining. Like I said, the roads are all concrete. The only time the plows are out is once it does snow. It usually snows maybe 2 inches or 3 inches. I think within the last 2.5 months, the biggest drop in snow that we've had, I think we've gotten 1 foot at a time.
Wow.
And it's almost gone instantly. It's really nice weather. You know, it's been consistent on the drizzling rain.
Right.
We've had some heavy pouring rain, but no consistent snow.
Well, Valdez is a lot like a lot of places in Southeast where historically, a lot of their snow happens at 30, 31, 32 degrees. So just a slight bump up in temperatures will turn a 12 or 18 inch snow into an inch or inch and a half rain. My understanding is that up at the at Thompson Pass, the snow course data up there, and Rick would know better than I, but they're kind of closer to normal. So it's something analogous to what's going on here in South Central, where at the higher parts of Alyeska and at Turnagain Pass, they've had dumps of snow, whereas closer to sea level, in a lot of cases, it's been, like at the base of Alyeska, it's been rain.
Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Unless, Rick, did you want to add something there?
No, that's thanks for that information, James. Very typical pattern with this southeasterly flow. So places that get precipitation above the snow line or the average snow line, there's a lot of snow. But in most places along the Gulf Coast, the snow line has been persistently above sea level. So where most of the people live, where the communities are, more rain than snow. Quite an expected pattern given our persistent southeast winds aloft.
Let's bring Lee from Fairbanks on now. He's on the line and has some observations as a pilot. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, I just I grew up north of Hooslea, and I just remember my mom telling us kids in the 70s that there was a lot more snow and the winters were colder, and a lot of the grass lakes and willow lakes around were actually full of water, and they used to drive around in them. And Howard Luke lived across from Fairbanks, told me the same thing. He's in his 90s, and he said all those lakes across the south of Fairbanks, grass lakes, were full of water. You could drive everywhere. And just last couple of warm years, winters, I noticed, just my personal observation. I don't know how verified it is, but it seems to be a lot more flow in the rivers. Of course, we know that the areas are open on the rivers, on the Yukon, for example, right below the bridge. Co-worker Milton Moses showed some aerial photos of, we both work on a pipeline, some open areas that he'd never seen below the bridge. He lived in Rampart and Tanana, so he'd never seen that. And between Galena and Keokuk, where the snow machine trail normally is the last several years, or a couple anyway, they've had to go around to a portage. And it's, of course, with the warmer winters, the ice is not freezing as well. But I think that also, there's just more flow in the rivers.
Hmm.
We've lost a couple of people back home. Snow machines going through, and so it's just dangerous out there. But also, part of my work on the pipeline is I've observed some off ice or overflow a lot of buildup. Well, we know what happened on the SAG last year, and I guess it's happening again this year. Is I'm just wondering if there's just an increase or sustained flow of groundwater down the slopes where during the warmer winters, where normally it freezes down enough that you don't get as much flow down slope in the winter. Happens all winter, and, you know, that's what feeds the rivers, the groundwater. Just wonder if we haven't had an increase of that feeding the rivers and creeks, and then when it hits, of course, obstructions like a drive lane or something, a road, you know, it fills up off ice. So just some observations.
Yeah, thank you for those, Lee. Rick or Brian, do you want to kind of follow up there?
Sure. Thanks, Lee. Good information. Certainly one factor the open water that's been observed and the higher levels, and probably also the alpha ice accumulation. The last two summers have been fairly wet across much of the central interior, and especially in the summer of 2014 on the North Slope. And so that water has got to go somewhere. And it, historically, we have seen when we've had wet summers that we do see more of this kind of thing during the winters as that water gradually moves downhill and eventually encounters something it can't go under or around, whether that be frozen ground or some other obstructions. So not too surprising between the wet summer and now really the very warm winter. And I think my guess is here, and I'm just guessing, but I think really the lack of any extended deep cold is probably playing an issue here too.
Mm-hmm.
We just have not had any sustained 40 below weather in interior Alaska this winter.
Let's get one more caller on before we have to take a short break. This is someone calling that knows a thing or two about snow. Jeff King is calling in from Denali. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for taking my call. I actually don't have any question that has to do with my mushing background, but I do have two questions. And one is, we hear a lot about and see what's happening in Alaska for warming temperatures, the 7 degrees that your guests are saying the difference is this year. I'm curious to know if they know for sure if it's happening throughout the entire Arctic Circle with Greenland and Siberia as well, and any other land or water mass within the Arctic Circle, if it's uniform. Because if it was, it seems like the snowstorms that they're implying we have affected the east coast of the U.S. Would have a swirl effect, and there would be snowstorms that affect other parts of Europe and or Japan and the Orient. So I was curious about that. And I was also curious, as far as the local observation, one of the most significant local observations I've had was last year's lack of mosquitoes were non-existent. And we generally are pretty scared of them all. So, and I wonder if they any reason to believe there's a connection there. And I'll let your guests answer, and I'll go off air.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, Jeff. Nice to hear from you, Brian. Brett Schneider, do you want to comment?
Yeah.
After Jeff King?
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's an honor to have you call into the program. This winter, the entire Arctic basin, so basically from 60 degrees north, was very anomalously warm. I think Alaska was 7 degrees above normal, but I believe the rest of the Arctic was even warmer than that. There are spots, as Jeff mentioned, there the jet stream and the flow does go up and down, and where it goes up and ultimately has to go back down, that there were areas like central Canada and the western part of Russia that, like for the month of February, were somewhat below normal, but those are the exceptions and not the rule. This winter was warm, all around the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
and not just a little warm, dramatically warm all around the Arctic.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk briefly with Tim Mowry with the State Division of Forestry about the concern for the wildfire season as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the winter that wasn't and the fact that Anchorage is embarrassingly having to borrow snow from Fairbanks for races that are coming up. Because of the low snowpack in some areas, the concern for an earlier and potentially more severe wildfire season is high. We've already had one wildfire near Delta Junction in February. Let's get Tim Mowry on the line now. Tim is the State Division of Forestry's Public Information Officer and is here to talk to us for a few minutes about the concern level for fire going into the spring. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Lori. How are you doing?
Good. Where are the big worry spots in the state from a fire concern?
Well, at this point in time, it's mainly south central Alaska, south of the Alaska Range. As you folks down there know, just by looking around, there's not much snow down there. North of the range, we've had decent snowfall this year. Although, as Rick Tolman pointed out, we haven't had any severe cold temperatures, but we've still got plenty of snow to play in and to that's covering the ground. But south of the range, and specifically Mattsu Valley, Kenai Peninsula, I saw a picture yesterday of a grass field in the valley that was grass as far as the eye could see.
And I know that because there's been a lack of a heavy snowpack, clearly. Because of that, that kind of combines with the drier conditions. Explain why that is when there's not a heavy impact from the snow itself.
Well, the snowpack tends to pack down grasses and vegetation, and it just isn't as prone to ignition and fire spread if something does happen. And you also have the benefit of snow melt, which, you know, is the equivalent of rain. It's just melting off. It's not falling from the sky. So the lack of snow there, it just allows things to dry out much quicker. So if there is an ignition source, whether it be a campfire or a chainsaw or a recreational vehicle, anything like that, it's going to take off quicker than it would if things were packed down and we had a normal snowpack.
So, Tim, are you concerned right now? I mean, what do you want Alaskans to do in response to this elevated concern about fire? Is the concern on as of today?
I think after last fire season, last summer's fire season, you know, where we burned 5.1 million acres plus around the state, and, we had the Sockeye Fire in Willow and the Card Street Fire where homes were burned. I think it's on everybody's mind. It's a conversation everybody's having, and the conditions this winter have just sort of exacerbated that. The potential for an early fire season, I think, is on all fire managers' minds. And what can people do? They can start thinking about firewising their home, and creating defensible space. I mean, these are terms now that I think are sort of household terms in a lot of ways because of the amount of fire we've had in the last decade in Alaska. And, you know, now there is no snow, so you can do things like clear trees around your house and clear brush and do things to make your home more resistant to fire. You know, if you're going to do, if you live in a place where burning is allowed, you know, it's better to do burning now because the potential for spread is low and dispersion for air quality is better now than it is when it gets hot and dry. And the one thing that we try to emphasize, and it's something we try to emphasize every year, but I don't think we can do it enough, is that people have to be really careful. A lot of things people don't, you know, think will start a fire can. I mean, you set a hot chainsaw down in a dry patch of grass, or you have a chain dragging from a trailer that's, you know, throwing up sparks on the road. You toss a cigarette butt out the window. All those things can lead to a wildfire, and it's, you know, the Sockeye fire was a human-caused fire. The Card Street fire was a human-caused fire. Those are preventable fires, and we can't do anything about lightning, but we can do things about human-caused fires, and that's the message that we're really trying to pound into the public, is you have to be careful and use common sense.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for that word to the wise, and please, everybody, pay attention, because it's going to take all of us to make sure that we don't have a spread of lots of human-caused wildfires this year. Brian.
And I'd like to add to what Tim said, that March and April, particularly, and to some degree May, are pretty much the driest months of the year, and they're also the windiest months of the year. So, you know, the first half of April, it's not a big deal if we have a foot of snow on the ground, if it's clear and windy and low humidity. But if it's clear and windy and low humidity with no snow on the ground, then obviously that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Before things green up, and that right. can also help mm-hmm. slow the growth of fire. Thanks so much to Tim Mowry for helping us keep our minds focused on helping to prevent wildfires this season. I want to go back to the phones here for a moment. Roger is in White Mountain, and he, I think, is going to be getting at something that Jeff King brought up about the lack of mosquitoes. And Roger has a comment about disappearing wetlands, and that might be connected to that. Hi, Roger.
Yeah, good morning. Everybody knows that Alaska is a wetland state from top to bottom with no normal snowfall covering the land. Are we looking at our wetlands disappearing? Alaska as a whole gets less precipitation than some of the deserts in the lower 48 states. Our coldness in Alaska is key to retaining our moisture content statewide. I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Roger, for that and that connection. You know, I wondered about the same thing, because we've heard the predictions for Alaska are warmer, wetter, but right. now we're also seeing this drying. What's going on?
Well, with regard to mosquitoes, I remember, at least here in Anchorage, and I can't speak for other parts of the state, the summer of 2013 was just horrible, horrible for mosquitoes. There were stories in the news about Fred Meyer and Car Safeway running out of bug repellent, so it was just awful. But then last summer, there was hardly any mosquitoes at all. I don't think I put on bug repellent once. So it's very possible that could be, because a few winters ago we were still melting off our snowpack here in Anchorage. That took, I think it was May 2nd that we lost our snowpack. So there was a lot of moisture. As far as wetlands, I believe Alaska is 47% water or wetland. And you know, there's a couple of good reasons for that. One is we have low evaporation rates. So even though we do get relatively meager precipitation, if you add it up, you know, Fairbanks gets somewhere around 10 inches and Anchorage only about 16 inches. But we have low evapotranspiration rates. So we generally, most of the state has more precipitation than evaporation. So we have this hydrologic surplus. And we also have permafrost covering more than 50% of the state, and that acts as a barrier that prevents the water from infiltrating farther down in those locations. So, in a warming environment, I'm speculating here, if your active layer of permafrost is basically farther down, that may enable more of the ground to absorb some of that the excess hydrologic surplus and perhaps reduce some of the wetland areas. Now that's separate than say thermokarst lakes up on the North Slope. But
yep. Rick Tolman, do you want to jump in here about either the effect on wetlands or mosquitoes?
So I would just echo Brian's comments. When we talk about in a warming world, more precipitation, people naturally think, oh, that would mean more surface water, more higher water levels in rivers in the summertime. But it doesn't necessarily work that way for exactly, as Brian has pointed out, even in areas where permafrost persists, that the depth to, that we have the thaw will influence how much surface water there is. In areas that don't have permafrost, if we're thawing out the ground sooner, that allows more time for water to percolate in. So our wetlands, our river levels, it's not a one-to-one relationship between how much precipitation falls out of the sky and how much winds up in our lakes and in our rivers.
That's a good point for everyone to remember. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. We have a lot of calls coming in. Alaskans are definitely interested in this issue of what's going on with our winter. Loretto is in Juneau. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was a meteorological technician throughout Alaska during the 70s. And I was in King Salmon, Kaktovik, in the Arctic, releasing weather balloons. And I'll never forget whenever I was flying to work, because I was mobile, I was transferred to a lot of places, basically chasing the jet stream and sending weather balloons up for pilots. And one of the things that was mentioned to me by a meteorologist that I was working with as we were flying over the Alyeska pipeline was the burning of the gas. And this hazardous gas is made of hydrogen sulfide, H2S. And one of the things he said was, you're going to see a radical change in our climate in 30 years. Because when you burn and continue to burn in one of the most delicate environments in the world, especially in our Arctic and Antarctic, you are creating a disaster.
Well, let's get Brian Brettschneider or Rick Tolman to respond to that. Thanks for the call, Loretto. And this maybe in conjunction with what we know of the permafrost as it melts, it's belching out right. methane. And so how do all these things combine to really have a big impact? And what's known about that?
Well, I can't speak specifically to the hydrogen sulfide release that Loretta is referring to. I think they stopped doing the weather balloons, and Rick would know better, in Kaktovik, I think sometime in the mid-1980s.
1988. Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the reasons they flare the excess gas at oil fields is the, methane is a 30 times more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So when you burn it, you chemically change it in a roundabout way from methane to carbon dioxide and some other stuff as well. So, but as you mentioned, permafrost, when you melt the permafrost, it allows the microbial activity to kick back in and to biodegrade the organic material that's collected there for tens or hundreds or however many years. And that converts basically, the carbon that was frozen away in that organic material into greenhouse gases. And so a lot of people are really concerned that that is a ticking time bomb.
Well, and kind of following along that same line, Barrow officials are asking for federal help with a seawall to protect the community from storm surges that could possibly compromise their drinking water supply. They would need $1 billion for the seawall. The impacts and future potential impacts to coastal infrastructure are becoming clearer all the time. How much and how quickly has this changed in the last two decades? What's known about that, what we're seeing along the coastlines?
I'll take a stab first. A lot of coastal communities in Alaska are experiencing not only rising sea levels, it's a combination of the rising sea level, but it perhaps in Alaska more significantly, the lack of sea ice and the later date of ice moving in along the shore. So that the storms, say, that in October and early November in the Bering Sea that would normally that have been common for a long time, always been common, wouldn't have that much of an impact along, you know, the west coast of Nome and Shishmaref and Kivalina, because the land areas would be locked in with sea ice, or the coastal areas would be locked in with sea ice. So those big waves were buffered from ever making it to the coast. And the same is true with Barrow, that the seasonal sea ice pack takes longer to come in the fall and leaves earlier in the summer. So it leaves, there's much more time for storms to whip and longer fetch for the winds to whip up large waves. And so I think that's more the issue along particularly the north coast of Alaska, but also the west coast of Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear from Marlene in Deering, who has a comment that's kind of along that line about shoreline. Hi, Marlene.
I worried about the sand spark kicking in my brain about this global warming. Not only it's man-made too, like from mining and oil and gravel extraction along the rivers for building roads and airports and the mouth of our river here is getting games should get us grant to open that river.
Yeah, more. Marlene, we're having a really hard time hearing you. I don't know what's going on, but I think what she's referencing, if I caught some of it, I'm sorry that we can't hear you, Marlene. The effect of extracting gravel from the shorelines for infrastructure buildup. That's probably an area that maybe climatologists can't comment on a lot, but you'd like to take a stab at it, please do.
From a long-term climate change perspective, it's hard to, I'm having a hard time thinking of a direct connection, you know, other than the industrial activity that goes along with road building and exposing permafrost and the combustion associated with the actual mechanical activity and the development that it's perhaps intended to promote.
Mm-hmm. Rick Toman, I felt like you wanted to jump in there before we took that last call. Was there something you wanted to add?
I would just add to Marlene's call. Her observation really quite important in that for all of us, our changing environment is all local, and things happening on the local scale of gravel extraction on your beach cascading all the way up to global greenhouse gas concentrations. That's all part of the mix of what us individually, our families, our communities experience in the world of environmental change. So while a gravel extraction on the large scale is not important, we don't think on the local scale it can be a significant contributor. And probably many listeners can think of local activities in their community that are contributing in one way or another to the impacts of the larger environmental changes.
That's an excellent point. Excuse me. Thank you, Rick, for making that point that in the global picture, it may be very small, but when you live right next to these things, it can have huge impacts and certainly can impact the lives of communities along the coast. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take more calls and more questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking about winter and the changes that we're seeing. So to my guests here, Brian Brettschneider and Rick Thoman in Fairbanks, our climate experts, beyond the East Coast, how is warming in the Arctic impacting other places in the world? I mean, we talked a little bit about the jet stream, but are the impacts, clearly they're impacting other places.
Well, the Arctic is, you know, the world's refrigerator. It helps keep the global temperature system in balance. Excuse me. So, you know, one of the things we haven't really talked about is the effect of the reduction in Arctic sea ice. Mm. And that has declined dramatically in the last, really the last 20 years in particular. And so far this winter, we had the lowest January extent on record. And they haven't come out with the February data, but I believe it's going to be the lowest February sea ice extent and perhaps volume on record as well. And so, you know, these things that occur up here in the Arctic, not only does it affect us most directly, but it really affects everyone else because the ocean in particular, you know, when you remove that ice off it, it becomes a very efficient heat absorption mechanism. And so for 6 months out of the year, it's completely in sunlight. And, you know, if it's accumulating solar energy for 6 months, that's a lot of heat. Whereas in the past, it might have only been accumulating heat for maybe four of those 6 months. And so that, you know, that change in sea ice regime really affects global temperature patterns. Like we talked about the jet stream, but it also, you know, affects winds and moisture transport and just so many other cascading impacts.
Let's go back to the phones quickly. Alex is in Anchorage and has a question about El Nino. Hi, Alex.
Yes. Hi there. How are you doing?
Good.
My question is the recent last 2 years, the storm tracks coming into South Central Alaska and our lack of snow here in Anchorage. Is that directly, is it due to the El Nino pattern that we've had, and have we experienced the similar conditions before from El Nino?
Rick?
I'll take it off the air.
All right. Thanks, Alex, for the question. Rick, I'm glad that somebody brought that up because I've been wanting to get to a question about El Nino, and I think it's losing steam, morphing into the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, but tell us a little more about what's going on there.
Okay, so this year, unlike last year, there has been a strong El Nino in the equatorial Pacific, and what this means is that where the giant deep tropical thunderstorms form has shifted east from its usual position, usually back towards Papua New Guinea, and the Solomon Islands now shifted east to the dateline and east, so it's kind of south of Hawaii. And this is important for the globe because those big tropical thunderstorms then influence the jet stream by throwing lots of momentum and moisture into the upper atmosphere that spirals away from the equator. The weather that we've had in most of Alaska this winter is consistent with what we've seen in strong El Niños in past years. Everyone is, of course, somewhat different. El Niño is only one of the players, of course, that's driving the climate system. We've got many different factors, but what's happening in the tropical Pacific is a big one, and what we've had this year is consistent. We did not have much of an El Niño last year. It tried, but it really failed. Sea surface temperatures did warm, but the atmosphere was never really able to connect with that. So we can't blame, for instance, last winter's lack of snow and warm temperatures on El Nino. And it's a good example of how all of these things get integrated to bring us the winter that we get or don't get.
How comfortable are the two of you? Weather forecasting used to be really good for about 24 hours, and then it sort of started to degrade pretty dramatically percentage-wise after that. How has that changed, and how comfortable are the two of you with climate models that scientists use today? How accurate do you think they are for the next decade or two decades?
Well, I'll defer to Rick, but I think there's an important distinction to make about there's several types of climate models. There's the forecasting models that look out for, you know, 1 to 15 days, or maybe even longer than that. And then there's climate models mm-hmm. that look at seasonal and even, you know, longer periods of time. So those are really two separate things. So I'll defer to Rick on the forecasting models, but the climate models are, they do what's called a hindcast testing. So they set all the parameters in it, and they say, well, before we say, well, how is this going to do looking forward? We'll say, well, let's run it in reverse and see how well it matches up with what's already occurred. So, Rick, do you want to chime in on how forecasting models have improved over the years?
Please do, Rick. We have about 1 minute.
Sure. So weather forecasting models have improved dramatically in my 30-year career from a couple of days on out. Even here in Alaska, we often have a pretty good idea out 5 to 7 days in advance. Climate models are also rapidly advancing. We're trying to forecast different things, but it's quite an exciting time to be in this business as we're seeing leaps and bounds in the science.
Well, we didn't get to some calls, and Joe was in Petersburg and wanted to ask about solutions, but that might be for another show that we'll have to talk about solutions. In the last just few seconds here, I know that the what we've heard is predictions of warmer weather for Anchorage. Is that still tracking to be true in the long term, that we're going to see more precipitation here?
Well, from a physical theoretical point of view, it makes sense. You could certainly have years like this year where the winds come down off the mountains and dry things out. But there's every reason to believe that things will be warmer and wetter.
Well, thank you so much to my guests, Brian Brettschneider, who is a climatologist, and he's with the International Arctic Research Center at UAF, although based in Anchorage. And also Rick Toman, who is with the National Weather Service, and Tim Maury, who was on from the Division of Forestry, thanks to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge on phones. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Regional Hospital. With hospital-wide renovations and upgrades, it's a brand new day at Alaska Regional Hospital. And by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.